Well, hello everyone, and welcome to National Bugle Radio. This is our first podcast in a few weeks. I'm Patrick Slattery, and today I have with me Don Advo. Hello, Don.
Hello, Patrick Slattery, and greetings from behind the lines in Mexican-occupied California. Really, great to be speaking with you today.
Well, thank you for being on. So much has happened in the past several weeks. There's a lot that we could be talking about. There's certainly the presidential campaign. There are these riots. There's international events. But the riots got me thinking about things. We do have this race problem, which is, in large part been fueled and exacerbated by this narrative of injustice towards blacks. We could go into that, but there's a lot of ways of researching this and seeing that there's really not the bulk of the injustice in terms of the black-white relationship in our lifetimes has been, black crime and black aggression and black violence towards whites. And there's narrative that it's the opposite, but it really runs counter to people's experiences. And I think, more and more, when you have the riots like in Milwaukee, where you had a completely unsympathetic black criminal shot by a black police officer, and then blacks go out and riot and specifically target whites, and then film themselves targeting whites, and it's out there. Even CNN, when trying to edit, the sister of the criminals, trying to incite the rioters to go off to white neighborhoods and burn their stuff down. It's just getting hard to keep up this narrative. And people know about it. So many people have experience with this from having gone to schools where black kids are routinely pick fights or bully white kids. And it doesn't go the other way. I mean, that's just some sort of crazy Hollywood fantasy that black kids are being bullied by whites. It's the other way around. And that brings me back to a discussion we had in a previous show where you talked about Brown versus the Board of Education. And you had a lot to say about it in terms of your reading of it, that it's really turned white children into some sort of property for blacks. You were saying it invested property rights in white children for the black community, something like that. You could explain it much better than
right.
me. So why don't you explain how you read the Brown versus the Board of Education?
All right. Brown versus the Board of Education was the famous United States Supreme Court decision handed down in 1954. And it was a number of cases were consolidated. And the issue was whether or not you could have racially segregated schools based on skin color. And the case was decided ostensibly on the basis of the 14th Amendment, which says no state can deprive a citizen of equal protection of the law. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it remembered, but it's that's the gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can't understand. Now, a case had been decided in 1896 called Plessy versus Ferguson. And this was supposed to be the controlling legal authority on the issue of race relations. And see, Plessy, that's where the doctrine separate but equal comes from. Plessy involved a train, public transit. And the question raised in Plessy was, did it violate the 14th Amendment to have racially segregated sections on a train? A black car and a white car. And the United States Supreme Court came down and said, insofar as public accommodation was concerned, it did not violate the Constitution to have separate accommodations as long as they were equal. You could have separate but equal.
And so that's where the separate but equal doctrine comes from. It comes from public transportation.
Yeah, and that's where the term colorblind comes from, too. It comes from the Plessy decision. Now, Plessy was relied upon for a whole bunch of lines of cases, including school desegregation cases. The blacks were always beating the drums to be allowed for their children to attend white schools. Now, they shot back with, now we're going to give you your own schools, and as long as they're equal, that satisfies the constitutional requirements under Plessy. Well, there were many instances where the black schools weren't equal, they were underfunded, and in other cases they were actually overfunded so that school districts believed they would be more easily able to defeat a constitutional challenge in that particular district.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my own district because my mother taught at a black school, and I went there in the summer, and when she was teaching summer school, and it was identical to my school. But I'm aware that that's not necessarily always the case everywhere, but that was the case in some areas for sure.
Right, right. Well, the blacks were always beating the drums for. There's this kind of this weird schizophrenia. Blacks are have always had this hatred of white people as racists and bigots and Jim Crow, and the white people are the source of all the evils of the universe. But at the same time, they want to move into our neighborhoods and live next door to us and send their children to our schools. So you have this weird kind of schizophrenia that has pervaded race relations, I guess, since the founding of the country and certainly since the end of the Civil War. Now, the first Civil Rights Act that was passed by the federal government was one of a number of Reconstruction laws. It was the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and basically what it said is that all citizens would have the rights to testify in trials and sit on juries and own property and file lawsuits and transfer property and draft wills equal to the rights enjoyed by white citizens. And that was the language it used, equal or the same as rights enjoyed by white citizens. So that was the first civil rights law, and actually in the aftermath of the
Civil War. And when was that? What year was that?
1866.
1866, okay.
No, it was obviously passed by a Reconstruction Republican Congress.
And that was that after the adoption of the 14th Amendment and the ratification?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it was or not. It was an act of Congress. It was not an amendment.
Okay.
I know it was after the 13th Amendment. I'm not sure about the timing of the 14th Amendment.
13th Amendment, which made
the 13th
black
Amendment
citizens,
abolished slavery.
13th and, abolished slavery.
Yeah. The 13th Amendment, there's kind of a weird history to that. It's just two sentences. It says, I'm not sure what it says, there shall no more be longer slavery or involuntary servitude in this country. And the second part says Congress shall be vested with the power to enact laws to deal with this. And the weirdness of the 13th Amendment, I looked at the legislative history one day. I was doing some research in the law library, and I was stunned to see that the 13th Amendment, according to the West Annotated Federal Code, was ratified by the state of Virginia in February of 1865. Now, that's going to set off some alarm bells for well-read people, because the South didn't surrender
until April.
Until April. So, I mean, 2 months before the surrender, the South, the state in which was located, the capital city of the Confederate States of America, ratified the 13th Amendment. I pinched myself and rubbed my eyes and read that again and took another swallow of very strong coffee, and it still said the same thing. That's kind of on my to-do list of things to do, to research the ratification process. I'm sure it must have been done by some kind of occupation rump state legislature or something. I cannot imagine the state legislature of the capital state of the Confederacy ratifying the 13th Amendment two months before the end of the Civil War. But you look at that period of history, yeah, a lot of really horrible things
were
done.
You know, the northwestern counties of Virginia were separated and turned into West Virginia in 1863, and the Constitution does not allow for the territory to be taken from a state without the state's consent. So,
yeah, the whole rule of law. I mean, the essence of the Civil War was the transformation of America from a central government that derived its just powers from the consent of the governed to one that derived its powers from the conquest of the governed. We became what were free states, whereas Wendell Phillips once said, now conquered provinces. So it was kind of a shotgun. The reunification, so-called reconstruction of the Union was really no more than a shotgun wedding. In any event, The Civil Rights Act of 66 vested blacks with rights that were equal to those enjoyed by white people. And in the aftermath of the Civil War, of course, that made perfect sense because it defined the legal status of black people, former slaves, and answered a lot of very, very perplexing questions. I mean, you wanted to get a devastated region of the country back on its feet. Did these people, obviously these people were going to have to go back to work, and they wanted to work, and did they have the legal capacity to contract? You know, what legal capacity did they have? And this answered that question, and it imposed a measure of order. And then in the aftermath, you have all kinds of proposed civil rights acts. Some were precursors of the Civil Rights Act of 64, which would ban racial discrimination in Congress.
Of 1964, I'm just trying to clarify.
Yeah, 1964, and of course those were shot down, and you have this huge political struggle for power. In any event, Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, and then you have all these fights over schools. And in 1954, the United States Supreme Court overruled Plessy versus Ferguson and said that separate but equal was inherently unequal, and that among other things, putting black children in separate schools stigmatized them and was a badge of inferiority, blah, blah, blah. But the most interesting thing to me in reading the Brown versus the Board of Education opinion was the way that the court framed the actual legal question, the actual legal issue. Now, there's a lot of rhetorical flourish in the Brown decision about how public education is the most important function of the government, and you know, if without professional training and schooling, we can't have a democracy and we can't have a country, and all these platitudes. When it came down to identifying the actual legal question presented, the court identified that question to me in a very startling way, and I almost had to rub my eyes and read it again to make sure I was reading it correctly. This is how the United States Supreme Court defined the issue. And if you want to, you can just Google Brown versus the Board of Education and read it for yourself. The actual citation is 347 U.S. 483 at page 493. And this is how the court defines the legal question. It says, "We come then to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does." Think about that sentence. And what it says is that it is the separation of children based on race which deprives the minority children of an equal educational opportunity. And what does this mean? It means it is the physical presence, whether voluntary or compelled, of the white child. The physical presence of the white child that is the educational opportunity, the deprivation of which is a violation of a constitutional right of the black child. What does this mean in practical terms? It means, see, it doesn't say, the Brown decision doesn't say black children have a right to an equal education, to a good education, to a bad education, to a superior education. It says they have the constitutional right to force white children to sit in the same classroom because the compelled physical presence is an educational opportunity. The effect of the Brown decision and the cases that came after that was to vest black people, black children, with property rights in the compelled physical presence of captive white children. The effect of the Brown decision was to force school districts to maintain inventories of captive white children so they could be distributed to classrooms in the kind of a manner of school supplies.
Wow.
Now, this is completely turning on its head the whole Civil War scenario, the whole narrative of the liberation and the emancipation of black people. And why do we fight the Civil War? Purportedly to overthrow a regime in which one race of people was vested with property rights in another race of people. Now, remember what the Brown decision says. Does the separation, the segregation of children in public schools based on race deprive the minority group of equal educational opportunities? Raise the question another way. Does the separation of a black agricultural worker from a white plantation owner deprive the white plantation owner of an economic opportunity? Well, yes, it does. If the black slave runs away, the white slave owner has lost the benefit of the product of his labor. That is to say, an economic agricultural opportunity. And I've heard, to me, this seems really self-evident. You know, you read it a couple of times and think it through. It really is self-evident that what the United States Supreme Court created here in Brown, and this is bolstered by reading of all the decisions that came after Brown, is that they vested blacks with property rights and white children. And there was a case in Michigan, forget the name of the case, something versus Michigan, and it was a very famous Supreme Court case. I should know it. And the problem in Michigan was that the Detroit school district, all these white people ran away. They ran away from the inner city schools so they could escape, you know, forced racial integration. They didn't want their children to go to school in racially integrated schools because of the diminished quality of education and because of the physical violence. So the question was, could they cast a net over the suburbs and drag the white children in the suburbs back into the inner city on buses, and could they bus black children to the white schools in the suburbs? And if you look back at the history, you know, American
and
history.
And when what time are we talking about with this Detroit case?
The 1960s.
1960s.
Late 60s. I think it was 69. I've got the book here in front of me, and I should be able to find that. But in any event, it's an easy case to find. I'll probably find it 2 hours after the show is over. But in any case, the issue was whether or not they could pursue these they could include they could reach out. See, prior to this decision, prior to the Michigan decision, they could only look in one, you know, Detroit. Detroit could only integrate its own schools. And they were saying, yeah, but these dirty, rotten white people are running away. And when you look at history, the fugitive slave laws were passed in order to stop black people from running away from white people. And look at the civil rights laws, the judicial opinions, the various Civil Rights Act, and you can see the so-called civil rights regime, the Orwellian misnamed civil rights regime, was designed for the exact opposite purpose. It was designed to keep fugitive white people from running away from blacks. And blacks go out to the suburbs, and they've got to chase them down. In the case, they said, well, these suburb schools, they're new school districts, they have no history. They have no history of discrimination, so there's nothing to remedy. And of course, the issue isn't remedying a past injustice, because the victims of that injustice are long gone. The issue is punishing white people and punishing white school children. So the issue is not the quality of education. None of these cases are decided on the basis of the quality of education. They are decided on how do we keep white people from running away from black people. There's no such thing as a white school. There are white children. They don't want a white school. They don't want a building that's been painted white, even by white painters. That's not the issue. It's not the issue at all. So what you see here under Brown versus the Board of Education is the stripping of white children of the most vulnerable, the most innocent group of people, children of their legal rights to say, we don't want to be thrown into a shark tank full of blacks, and to give blacks the superior legal status to demand and compel the physical presence of white children based on race. And what the Supreme Court did in Brown, and in the decisions that followed, was to create a new kind of property right, a property right, a possessory interest in human beings vested for the benefit of one race, a superior race, the black race, and against the legally subordinate white race. I'm not aware of any opinion that's ever come down that says white people have a right to force their way into a black school because being next to a black child is some kind of educational opportunity. Of course, they came up with the diversity fraud, I think the 1980s, which maybe was the way of dealing with that. But the point of the Brown decision is that it created a legally enforceable property interest, a possessory legal interest in human beings.
Okay.
And this is after we fought a civil war, 90 years after we fought a civil war, to do away with that kind of thing. And that's my interpretation of the history of the civil rights movement. Slavery was designed to stop black people from running away from whites, and the civil rights regime is designed to stop white people from running away from blacks.
Okay, I want to get into just a little bit of the history, a couple of questions. So this was 1952. Oh, 54. Okay, so Earl Warren was the Chief Justice at the time.
Correct.
Former governor of California, former presidential candidate, I believe, too. And who wrote the opinion? Do you recall?
I probably some law clerk actually wrote it. It was signed off by Earl Warren. I don't know who actually wrote
it. Okay, I'm just wondering. Okay, I remember the first time we talked about this, and I'm a policy analyst, and so I look at policy and you know what kind of outcomes are produced, and I remember you just saying, I don't care what kind of outcomes it produces, and because you're a lawyer, and so you're looking at it constitutionally, you're looking at it legally, and you're looking at issues that, you know, as a policy analyst, wouldn't have been the first things that I would have focused on. So it's very interesting. Now, also, you could look at it as, say, a political scientist. What are the politics of it? And the politics of it seem to be changing. It does seem that race relations have gotten worse. People keep saying that. I mean, people have been saying it. You know, they'll say it just because Obama was elected, race relations have gotten worse. But I think on a whole number of objective measures, racial relations have gotten worse. Blacks are feeling more and more as if, you know, they lack justice, which, of course, is really the opposite, I think, is demonstrably true. This notion that they've got some real grievance against the entire white race, and they're being held down. They're being brainwashed with this notion. They're being incited to violence. The violence is getting more and more palpable, and more documented. One thing that's the phenomenon of the internet, which is making the narrative less and less plausible. This narrative of white oppression against blacks. I mentioned earlier we have this there's this person on an author investigative journalist named Colin Flaherty, and many of the listeners might be familiar with him. He has a YouTube channel. He's written books, White Girl Bleed a Lot, and another Don't Make the Black Kids Angry, and then he has this YouTube channel where he has 50,000 subscribers, and they send him links to often it's to local news broadcasts, which are, there's just day after day. I mean, he posts several videos a day, and day after day there are cases of black mob violence and black murder of whites, black on white murder, black on white. He doesn't even get into the whole rape thing, which is huge. But there's things like that. And then, of course, also you have with cell phones everywhere. I mean, cell phones were supposedly going to be expose the blow the lid off police oppression of blacks, but blacks with their own cell phones have been documenting their own violence and then posting it thinking it's funny. I mean, like the knockout game stuff, there's just so much that's been posted by blacks of blacks being violent against whites, and And so it's all out there in a way it wasn't before. It just can't be hidden anymore. And so I think the relations have gotten worse, and B, it's harder to hide. And I think the politics are changing. I think, you're seeing the Trump phenomenon, and then just in the past couple of weeks, this Trump resurgence in the polls, which aren't necessarily to be trusted, but this Trump resurgence in the polls would have to do with, Hillary having Black Lives Matter martyrs' mothers at her convention, at her coronation, and then all this completely unjustifiable violence in Milwaukee and other cities, which is just going to that's more likely to give the election to Trump than anything else. So I think the politics is changing. So then my next question becomes, if you have, I know it would depend on who might be the replacements in the Supreme Court for people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. They're old, they're going to be replaced. If you had a court that might be willing to review Brown versus the Board of Education, what type of case would be a case that could be brought before the court to get a reconsideration or perhaps an overturning of Brown versus the Board of Education?
Okay, before I go into that, I want to clarify a couple of points that I made. The Michigan case was not a 1974 case called Milliken versus Bradley. And let me just summarize that case briefly. I'll read a couple of sentences from a book called All Deliberate Speed by Charles J. Ogletree Jr. He's one of these affirmative action Black civil rights lawyers. He now teaches at Harvard. He says the turning point came in 74 with Milliken versus Bradley, which prohibited federal courts from using multi-district remedies to ameliorate segregation that was endemic in one district only. In Milliken, white flight from the city out of Detroit led to increasingly minority urban areas and white suburbs. The suburban areas had no history of segregation. Okay, it says, the more and more conservative Supreme Court concluded that white families that moved to the suburbs should not be penalized through remedial measures, even though their actions led to segregated uniform schools, end quote. Now listen to what he just said, that white families that moved to the suburbs should not be penalized through the application of the Brown decision.
Now, and this, who wrote
you're
this?
You're not talking about helping Black people. You're talking about punishing white people.
Okay, so they should or should not be punished.
That's the purpose of this. And so the purpose is to humiliate and relegate white people to a subordinate legal status.
And so what you're reading, what are you reading from? You were reading from this 74...
The quote that I just read to you, which characterized the Milliken versus Bradley decision.
Which was 74.
The book is titled All Deliberate Speed, published by... written by Charles J. Ogletree Jr.,
the Black Harvard professor.
He's a Harvard professor. He's one of these NAACP types. He was a child of Brown. It was published in 2004. All Deliberate Speed. I read this book, and this is I owe this guy a certain intellectual debt for the insight that he gave me into the Brown decision. And to all these decisions that follow. The purpose is not to uplift Black people. It is, as he says himself, white families that move to the suburbs should not be penalized. Now, remember, the Plessy case dealt with adults. It dealt with adults who bought tickets to ride on a railway car. These are contracts. Children in public, children have no contractual capacity. They don't have the capacity to contract. So the idea that an opinion which protects the contract rights of adults or regulates the contract rights of adults, such as Plessy, that it should really have any relevance to the whole issue of children in public schools is to me, really schlocky thinking and reasoning. It's very sloppy. And you look at these opinions, they're just incredible. I mean, do the white children not have some rights here?
Well, no.
The Supreme Court says, no, they don't. The Supreme Court in Brown and its progeny, a term we use in the law, which refers to the cases that came after, is that, no, they don't. And for if you ask what type of case is going to be necessary to overturn Brown, the short answer is, I don't know the answer unless some bold person is just going to come and representing a school district and say, yeah, we have a right to separate school children for their own protection. We have a bunch of white children here who don't want to go to school with blacks. But you see, that case was litigated in Virginia. They had a town that just said, look, in our town, anybody can go to any school they want. 80% of the blacks went to an all-black school, and 99% of the whites went to an all-white school. And the Supreme Court stepped in there and said, you can't do that. That's wrong.
And when was that?
To do with the personal preferences of anybody.
And when was that?
Top-down racial caste system imposed on our country.
Okay. And that case in Virginia, when was that?
Oh, I think that was the Green case. I think it was in the 70s.
I'm aware that in the mid-60s, there was a couple of years that where many Virginia school districts were shut down.
Green versus County School Board. Yeah, it was the Green case, and there were a whole bunch of cases. You read these cases on school desegregation, and they just make you. It filled me with anger and rage. Mm-hmm. I mean, even more so than watching videos about black people raping and murdering and pillaging and torturing white people. There's a different kind of rage you feel when some affirmative action black in his three-piece suit, teaching at Harvard, writes a book that openly advocates punishing white people for the sins of long-dead slave owners and enslaving white children. I only wish I could find the words to describe the rage that that makes me feel. But perhaps your listeners can infer it from the tone in my voice or whatever. But that's what you're looking at. The whole purpose of these Supreme Court decisions was to punish white people and humiliate white people.
Okay.
So, and I hear people in our movement say, well, by the problem with forced racial segregation is that it doesn't work and you get poor educational quality. And so if it produced good educational outcomes, you would defend the enslavement of white children?
So
I wouldn't. I think people don't understand the argument.
Okay. So this gets back to the question. If you were trying to think of a case, find a case to go before the Supreme Court that could lead to the overturning of Brown versus the Board of Education, would a case based on bad educational outcomes or safety of the children, the crime rates, could something like that do the trick? Or could a case be found where you're getting directly to what you just outlined, the idea of property rights in white children? I mean, is there a way you could make that argument, have that argument be part of a case that would
then... I've never read the briefs of that case, and I don't know what the arguments were made in that opinion. It strikes me there were a lot of really great arguments that have never been made. The first of which, I am the only person I have ever heard of who realized what the holding in Brown said.
I've never heard anybody say it either, but...
Does segregation of children in public schools on the basis of race deprive the minority children of equal educational opportunities, even if the same amount of money is spent, even if everything else is the same? And the answer is yes, it does. We believe it does. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis of the decision, is that white children are an educational opportunity, and if you say black children are going to be denied the presence of white children, that violates the black child's constitutional rights. It's a possessory interest in human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that not clear?
Well, I'm not. I'm not a legal mind, really.
Mind. If a black agricultural worker running away from his white slave owner violates the rights of the slave owner, is that not a legally enforceable possessory interest in human beings? I have a right to possess you because you're black and I own you and you're my slave.
Well, I don't have an argument. I can't think of an argument. Not that I'm inclined to, but
if the white plantation owner says, "Excuse me, Mr. Black Slave, your presence here You run away and you deny me an economic opportunity. Therefore, I have a right to throw a net over you and make you pick my cotton against your will. The Supreme Court in Brown says, excuse me, white child trying to run away, white family trying to run away. Your child's presence in this classroom represents an educational opportunity for these minorities, and we're not going to let you run away. They're indistinguishable. It is a possessory interest in human beings, just mm-hmm. like slavery. Only under slavery, you know, all white people didn't own all black people. There were free blacks, and there were free blacks who owned slaves. Under the new civil rights regime, the scheme, the legislative scheme and the judicial opinions, all black people do own all white people. There were free blacks under slavery. There's no free whites under the new civil rights regime. There are people like the Clintons and wealthy people who kind of buy their way out of it. But there's no free whites. Martin Luther King once said, that there's no amount of money that could ever compensate the Negro, as he called him, for all of this shame and degradation, blah, blah, blah. They have suffered at the hands of the white race. But of course, you know, $50 billion would be a nice down payment. So he advocated this weird caste system, this caste system whereby blacks were elevated to a superior legal status as a debtor, a creditor race, and white people were lowered to a subordinate status as a debtor race. And the debtor race owes the creditor race, you know, $50 billion. No amount of money can ever pay the debt. Now think about what that means. Under slavery, the freedom, the emancipation, the manumission of slaves could be purchased. A slave could buy his own freedom. Mm-hmm. Someone else could buy his freedom. If no amount of money will ever repay the blacks for the indignities they suffered, that means there's no price on white emancipation. There's no amount of money that can ever free the debtor race, the white debtor race, from the debts it owes the legally superior black creditor race. Mm-hmm. White people, white children are forever indebted to black children and black people. This is a racial caste system. Mm-hmm. And this monster, you know, gets to call himself a civil rights leader and gets to have a national holiday? What in the hell was wrong with Ronald Reagan when he signed off on that? It's like the color, it's this color blindness has extended from the perceiving physical colors into the brain. And I never heard any conservative lawyers, so-called conservative lawyers, analyze the plain language of the operative sentence in the Brown decision in the way that I have. And I've talked about it with lawyers behind closed doors, and they rub their eyes and say, by God, you're right. It does say that. That is what it means. Well, the white laity understands it. I promulgated this my doctrine, you know, the Advo doctrine of civil rights, you know, 3 years ago on my first internet podcast. Let me tell you, the white laity understands it and gets it. When you're a white parent and you've run away from the inner city because you don't want your kids thrown into a shark tank, you get it.
Okay, so I mean, I was prodding you earlier about trying to, what kind of case could overturn it. Another.
I just don't know. The answer is you're not going to litigate your way out of this.
Okay, so yeah,
it's going to take another civil war.
Well,
this is not going to be peacefully resolved.
Okay, how about another way of overturning Supreme Court decisions is by constitutional amendments.
Well, constitutional amendment, the court can revisit it, and reverse itself the way it did on Plessy and the way it did on some other cases as well.
So I know I'm putting you on the spot, but a constitutional amendment to remedy or overturn Brown versus the Board of Education, what would that look like?
A constitutional amendment? Yeah. All you would have to say is the holding in Brown versus pursuant to the holding in Brown versus... I'm not sure. The short answer is I'm not really sure.
Yeah, but it probably wouldn't take too long for you to think of it if you had to.
Well, I'd have to sit down and figure it out. I know the liberals are talking about an amendment to overturn... what's that case? The free speech case?
Citizens United.
Yeah, Citizens United. Okay. They're always talking about an amendment to do that. Maybe I'll bring that up and look at that.
Yeah.
Well, I hadn't really you know, I had kind of a plan for white emancipation. First plan was get rid of Brown versus Board of Education. Second, get rid of the Civil Rights Act of 64 because it stripped white people of their rights of freedom of association and their centuries-old rights of freedom of contract. And get rid of the Martin Luther King holiday because it is unseemly for a country based on racial equality to have an advocate of a racial caste system for whom we have a national holiday.
Yeah, I was in a post office recently, one of our dysfunctional post offices, and where once upon a time you might have seen a portrait of George Washington, there was a portrait of Martin Luther King. And I think the only, I looked on the walls, looked at the stamps. I think the only picture of a white person I saw was maybe Mickey Mantle standing next to Willie Mays, something like that. So here's my next question is, let's just say through whatever means Brown versus Board of Education is overturned. What do our schools look like after that? What would happen?
Well, you've got this. Well, I mean, I don't know if we can even legally have white communities anymore. You know, they're seeding these refugees all over the country, and they're putting illegal alien refugees everywhere. But I think if you did away with that, you might have an ability to have, you know, still have racially segregated schools.
So private schools or public schools?
Public schools, yeah.
Public schools.
Well, bear in mind, we have federally subsidized black historic colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I was stunned to find out about that. That was legal, but you know, that's what's so phony about these civil rights laws. They're only enforced against white people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have an all black newspaper here in Los Angeles called the Sentinel,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, question, you know, how in an era of bans against racial discrimination in hiring, do you have an all-black newspaper? Answer, that you violate civil rights laws and you only hire black people.
Yeah, and
to my astonishment, in there was an advertisement from a law firm, a California law firm, that said we are Southern California's best black law firm. My eyes popped out of my head. You have all these state bar rules of diversity and equal treatment, and you can't discriminate based on race. What would happen, you know, rhetorical question here, what would happen if I opened a white law firm? Well, I'd be put out of business overnight. There would be they would parachute in a SWAT team from the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and I'd probably be taken into custody or something. But you see, the civil rights laws that would be enforced against me with draconian impact are not enforced at all against, blacks or Hispanics. I mean, I've heard of women's law firm. I've seen this in legal publications. A women's law firm. Oh, can I have a man's law firm? Hell no.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a racial war being waged, but only white people are not allowed to participate. We are only allowed to be rolled over. We are not allowed to organize. We are not allowed to defend ourselves. And that's what's basically gone on. That was the whole purpose of the Orwellian misnamed civil rights regime, is to achieve the enslavement and ultimate genocide, the ultimate dispossession and ethnic cleansing of white people. And it's going to take pushback,
mm-hmm.
to deal with that. First of all, people have got to, you've got to help people achieve moral and intellectual clarity. You've got to understand what the civil rights thing really means. I mean, stripping white people of their civil rights so they can be rolled over and exterminated. And I think white people, I know I made that pitch, on Stormfront Radio and on other radio shows, and it's been very, very well received in the blogosphere, the white blogosphere, in the white internet radio talk show realm. So it seems to have struck a very powerful note. I think ultimately it's going to strike a more powerful note because people are looking for an idea. People have got to understand they have the moral high ground. Why don't whites fight? Because they've been stripped of the moral high ground. They've been stripped of the ability to even understand there is such a thing, except that occupied by the blacks. And when people think they don't have the moral high ground, they won't fight. So we have to have a narrative. We have to have an explanation. Do we achieve moral and intellectual clarity in our people so that they understand that they occupy the moral high ground? They should have equal rights. They should have equal rights to have a white association for the advancement of white people, a white law firm, a white community. We should have equal rights to all the other races that are engaged in racial warfare against us. But people aren't going to fight back until they have the rhetorical weapons. Mm-hmm. They need to have a narrative. Mm-hmm. And the narrative is the purpose of the civil rights movement was the enslavement of white people mm-hmm. and the establishment of a racial caste system in which white people are on the bottom.
Okay. And then getting to my final line of questioning, it seems that this 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education, that's a real sea change, because you had referenced before,
right,
1896, the Supreme Court had the doctrine of separate but equal. So 1954, right. Real sea change. So, you know, what brings it about? Now, Warren, I mean, was he just a self-hating white? Was this just liberals all of a sudden deciding that they want to commit mass suicide? Obviously, these are kind of rhetorical questions. David Duke or Kevin McDonald would say that you had a civil rights movement, which was very largely a product of a Jewish elite that was hostile to European Americans. Is this how you see it?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, the whole thing is a Jewish machination. There was a United States Supreme Court Associate Justice at that time named Felix Frankfurter, who was a very, very active Zionist, very powerful Jew, and they were pushing the Jewish agenda. I recently read a biography of a federal appellate justice named Learned Hand. Learned Hand was not Jewish, but he was a very bright Gentile, very bright Christian. And he went to Harvard, and he was sort of taken into the Zionist fold. But he was a very bright man, very, very well thought of. Kind of a conservative in certain ways, but he supported Brown. He supported a number of other decisions, and he was a good friend of Felix Frankfurter. And in correspondence between him and Frankfurter, Frankfurter talks about their agenda to use the federal courts to achieve all these goals. You know, first of all, premier goal was to integrate the schools, then to get rid of laws against miscegenation, to get rid of laws and, to establish a kind of a civil rights regime. Mm-hmm. And you see this guy Frankfurter working very, very, very determinedly behind the scenes, as did other Jews.
Felix Frankfurter, who was on the court for, 20, 30 years? He was appointed by Roosevelt.
He's on a long time, yeah.
And wasn't he, before he was appointed by Roosevelt, wasn't he one of Roosevelt's close aides? FDR's close aides?
No, I don't know.
You're not sure?
Yeah, I probably was.
I think he was. Okay, so, well, that's very interesting. I brought that up at the end because, you know, I mentioned Colin Flaherty earlier, and he's just such a source of information and documentation on the whole racial violence issue. And I listened to him, a podcast he made recently with Tommy Sotomayor, who introduced the Jewish involvement or the Jewish domination of the media, which Flaherty just immediately dismissed. And I don't mean to badmouth Colin Flaherty, because I think his work is extremely valuable. It's priceless. But the thing is, if you don't look at the Jewish role in all of this, you wind up with some sort of silly conclusion that either it's just, you know, liberals are stupid or liberals hate white people or
well, I think they do.
Well, but I mean, how did that come about? You know, why did liberals all of a sudden, because 70 years ago or 100 years ago, liberals weren't hating white people, you know, so why did all of a sudden this happen? Or you get the Alex Jones conclusion that it's, you know, some evil Nazi government, the secret government that's pulling the strings. That's why I brought it up.
Let me tell you something about the hatred of white people. There was a 1925 United States Supreme Court decision where in the state of New York, they wanted a chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. They had some statute that said private organizations have to have to open up their membership lists. And the Klan there said, sorry, you know, that violates our First Amendment rights of freedom of association. And it got all the way up to the Supreme Court. And they said, oh, this is the Klan. This is an organization with blood on its hands and murder and torture and terror, intimidation, blah, 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 blah. Of course these people have no rights of free association. Of course these dirty, rotten, filthy scum have no rights whatsoever. Who do these people think they are? This was the 1920s. And what's funny about this case is in the 50s, 1950s, the state of Alabama wants to subpoena the NAACP membership lists because they think the NAACP is violating corporate laws. They're soliciting a lot of license in Alabama or something. I don't even know where the NAACP was incorporated. I forget that. But this case, it was Alabama versus NAACP. That's where the right of freedom of association is credited with having been judicially created or judicially recognized as an implied right under the First Amendment. If you have a right to practice a religion, what is that except meeting with like-minded people? Mm-hmm. You know, they have a newspaper, a business, you hire people, or whatever. So you have a right to associate, to carry out free speech. You know, a lecturer and people speak, people listen. And it's eminently reasonable. But the state of Alabama cited the 1925 case that said, the state interest is greater than the individual's rights of freedom of association and anonymity. And the Warren Court, I think it was 56 or 57, said, well, you know, basically, what do you think you're talking about? You know, white people may not have these rights, but now we're talking about the NAACP. You know, get out of here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't say it quite that bluntly. But if you read it, they just blew off a prior Supreme Court case that said states have a right to inquire into the membership list of private organizations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that doesn't apply here. Those are white people. Get out of here. that would be an interesting show. I mean, the attitude of the United States Supreme Court toward free speech rights. I mean, if you think it's going to, if you think it would be bad under judges appointed by Hillary Clinton, I got news for you. It hasn't been all that great throughout the history of the 20th century. There are some Supreme Court decisions that are really horrible on the free speech issue. I mean, there was a meeting in Chicago in 47, Catholic priests, and I probably shouldn't talk about it if I can't cite it, but in any event, a Catholic priest tried to get up and talk about communism, and there was a mob, just like the left-wing mobs that we see today, and they wanted to arrest the Catholic priest for inciting violence. I mean, here's the guy in a building that he himself rented. He's attacked by a mob of these savages, and they want to prosecute him for inciting violence. And boy, some of these justices says, oh, this guy's a fascist, and what rights does he think a fascist should have anyway? You know, it's a horrible decision. I'm thinking, my God, this is 1947. If they were that hostile to white people even then, for God's sakes, And then I told you about the case in 1925, where they really came down on white people. And this is an all-white Supreme Court in 1925. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there were any Jews on the Supreme Court in 25.
Brandeis, wasn't he?
Yeah, Brandeis. But he was only one guy. So
There's the guy, the Sephardic Jew, Portuguese name, Cardoso.
Cardoso, was he on the Supreme Court?
He was. I don't think his tenure was that long. But he was on, I think, late in the 20s, maybe in the mid-20s. I'm not sure. But he was in that era.
Well, in any event, I read that biography of Learned Hand, which I stumbled across quite by accident at one of these 99-cent bookstores. You know, it's like a $50 book. I got it for 99 cents, and I'm reading, and it just about knocked my socks off. Mm-hmm. It was really astonishing. And this guy was supposedly a states' rights guy and a conservative guy, but he was very, very much cultivated by the Zionists, by Frankfurter. I mean, he and Frankfurter had a long, extensive correspondence. And the author of the book was some Jew, I forget his name, Jewish lawyer. And they all admired Learned Hand. And I'm still not quite sure why, but they did. And they wanted to put him on the Supreme Court. Huh. But There's a lot of admissions in that correspondence about their agenda. I mean, they had a the Jews had a blueprint laid out in a way that they were going to use the Supreme Court.
Well, I think, you know, we're coming up at the end of the show, but I think we've maybe got our next topic for the next time, if you're willing to come back on. We can talk about, you know, the attack on the First Amendment and the Jewish involvement in that. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and I look forward to doing this again with you soon.
Pleasure as always.
And we will see you next time on National Bugle Radio.